So it's a pleasure to be able to introduce a dear friend and colleague, Jerry Root. Jerry is the kind of person who really personifies that kind of stereotypical, this person needs no introduction. Yet here I am to introduce him, and let me just make just say a couple of things, because some of you, there may be some things about his background that some of you don't know about. It seems like everybody in the world's been in Jerry's youth group or has been married by him, except me and my parents. Jerry is, his official title here is Professor of Evangelism and Leadership, and he is the director of the Wheaton Evangelism Initiative, and he is also a member of the Billy Graham Center for Evangelism. He teaches all kinds of courses on evangelism and leadership, but also C.S. Lewis. I'll say something briefly about the C.S. Lewis stuff in a moment. He got his bachelor's degree at Whittier College. He did an MDiv at Talbot Graduate School of Theology, and then he did his PhD studies at the Open University in Britain. Jerry confesses he's not a very, he's sort of the least technical person, so the fact that the technology may be going goofy will perhaps present no obstacles to him whatsoever. His work, his thesis both for his MDiv and for his PhD were on C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis has been not the only, but one of the central foci of his scholarly life over the past few decades. He's published several books, several articles. He has spoken all over the world on C.S. Lewis. So I think he knows a thing or two about C.S. Lewis. And I've always found him to have something insightful to say, either in a talk or something he's written, or just in casual conversation when C.S. Lewis comes up. So I think you will find something really useful and really valuable from what he has to share with us this evening. A couple of fun facts about Jerry. One fun fact is that many of you may not know is that he makes his own wine. So, and it's good wine too. I've had the privilege of being able to have a few bottles of it. Not in one sitting, but to enjoy leisurely. Second fun fact is that, and I'm not sure if Jerry knows this, because I don't know if I've actually shared this with him, but he and my mother have something really interesting in common. She was not in his youth group, and she wasn't married, but they have something very interesting in common. Both of them have attended schools that Richard Nixon also attended. So Richard Nixon did his bachelor's degree at Whittier College. Not the same time Jerry was there. Jerry was a little bit after Richard Nixon. But my mother has the distinction of having attended the same school where Richard Nixon did his law degree. She was a Duke graduate. She was actually an undergraduate at Duke while he was at Duke doing his law degree work. So there's an interesting little juicy kind of connection. You just never know what kinds of little intersections you're going to have when people sort of come together. I mean, Jerry and I could tell you stories about all kinds of ways in which we found weird interconnections, intersections in different people's lives. So with no further ado, welcome. Jerry Root is going to talk to us tonight about C.S. Lewis and his thoughts on scientism, his case against scientism. So, Jerry.
Unfortunately, I'm not going to tell you anything about himself. He is a physicist. He's one of the smartest people I've ever met. He is a dear, dear friend, one of my closest friends in the world. And he taught not only here at Wheaton, but he taught at the University of Texas and he taught at Oxford University. So he's a pretty bright guy, and I'm always intimidated if I'm in front of him having to give a lecture, and especially about scientism. And so I have to begin this talk, C.S. Lewis and the Case Against Scientism, with some confessions. First confession, the title for the lecture is not original. It's drawn from Michael Ashleman's The Restitution of Man, C.S. Lewis and the Case Against Scientism. But any observed similarity to that book will primarily be due to our both drawing inspiration from C.S. Lewis as a common source. Furthermore, I was asked to draw on Lewis for this lecture. My master's thesis and PhD dissertations, as Robert mentioned, were both written about Lewis's, on Lewis themes. Most of my academic specialization is focused on Lewis. Most of my books have been written on him. I've been studying his work seriously for the past 48 years. I've been teaching constantly every year courses on him for the last 38 years. I've also given lectures on Lewis at 70 colleges and universities in 15 different countries. I do not say this to validate what I'm going to say, but rather to lend credence to this fact that I feel I am only scratching the surface of what can be known about Lewis and those authors that influenced him. And anyone who has spent a lifetime studying a particular author or idea or school of thought knows exactly what I'm talking about. We are people fundamentally pea brains. The Widener Library at Harvard University has 19 million volumes under that one roof. Who's read them all? The Bodleian Library at Oxford University has 136 miles of shelf space. When you fill out a reader's ticket, they pride themselves that they can have a book for you within 24 hours. Who's read them all? We're making judgments all the time, and we know so little. So I've studied Lewis all my life. I don't want to come across as if somebody here could raise a question and say, yeah, but what about this? And I'd say, wow, that's a good point. I forgot all about that. Anyway, there you go. Second confession. First confession is the title for this lecture is not original. Second confession. I am not a scientist. I'm among a bunch of scientists. Though my undergraduate degree is in the sciences, what is now called applied health science. It was once called kinesiology. But back when I was in school, it was called PE. And while I see that the applied health science people have been able to go on and get medical degrees or go on and get PhDs, back when I was in school, that particular degree was mainly for people trying to stay eligible or hoping they could one day get a coaching job someplace. So I must confess this. I do have to say this, though, a few things. Every time I have a student who's in applied health science or kinesiology class, I always ask them, do you know the Krebs cycle? And almost without exception, they don't, or they say, I once did. I say, I still remember it from college, even though you've forgotten it. So one day a student brought his textbook to class and it had these opaque pages and then it had these several pages of see-through pages and they had lines on them and so on. I said, what's that? He says, it's the Krebs cycle. And I say, how many stages does it have? He says, oh, somewhere in the realm of 80 to 90. And I said, oh. When I was in college, it had four. So when I say I'm not a scientist, it keeps getting progressively worse. Suffice it here to confess that in my formal studies, I only brushed up against the sciences as a moth brushes its wings against a lighted window. Third confession. C.S. Lewis, the Oxford Don, and later Cambridge professor, was not a scientist either. Certainly he had respect for the sciences. He remained all of his life an amateur astronomer, and he wrote knowingly about the history of science, most particularly about the medieval cosmology and his The Discarded Image. Nevertheless, he was not a person who focused his academic life on the material sciences. Nevertheless, I do think Lewis has something to say to the scientific community, and those who extend an invitation to me for this address, to address you this evening, have thought so as well, or they wouldn't have invited me. So let's talk about Lewis's case against scientism. While Lewis had respect for the sciences per se, he spoke out against what he called scientism. That is what he would call the religion of science. In order to keep matters clear, it must be added that Lewis was, in fact, a theistic evolutionist, and he held this view because he thought it was the conclusion indicated by honest scientific and theological study. And he wrote against scientism, naturalism, and materialism in several of his books and essays, in both his nonfiction and his fiction books. His nonfiction works such as The Abolition of Man and Miracles, as well as fiction works such as his science fiction, the trilogy, and even three of his Narnian books enter into a fictional depiction of the errors of scientism. Magician's Nephew, for one, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, and The Silver Chair come immediately to mind. And there are numerous essays where he speaks of these things particularly. The essay De Futilitate, his inaugural address for the endowed professorship of medieval Renaissance studies at Cambridge University, called De Descriptione Temporum, the description of the times, and most notably, the funeral of the great myth, on which I will lean heavily for this particular lecture. The funeral of the great myth. In this essay, Lewis begins by noting how each generation tends to depreciate the one immediately preceding it. Furthermore, any current age is often clueless of those things in its own age that are destined to be superseded. And more, most generations are also the conduit for the grand and human ideas that are of perennial value and of lasting significance. I say to my students each semester two important things that they have to know at the beginning of the class. One, I imagine I'll be retiring in a few years. I have books that I read and reread and reread. These are the books I traffic in. I have books that I must read for my academic work. I have other books that I long to read and just haven't had time, and they've been piling up, and when I retire, I'm digging into them. And as soon as I do, I'll be reading them saying, oh no. I said just the opposite of that to my students. And I'm going to be spending my retirement years praying for my students that their minds won't be too corrupted by the things that were uninformed by this new literature. But the other thing I tell my students is this, I have no clue who the names are of the drummers that you love to, of the bands you like to listen to. I have no idea who the names are of the bands you listen to or the lyrics of their music. Oh yeah, you don't know the names of the drummers of the bands I listened to when I was young either, nor the names of those bands or their lyrics. I said, so I'm not gonna offer you the pretense of suggesting I understand the culture you're living in. I don't think boomers can understand millennials, but I don't think you'll understand the culture I'm living in either, as far as those particularities are concerned. But if we read the liberal arts, what do we discover? There are some issues of perennial interest, the longings of the heart, the questions of the mind, the serious questions about a broken world that's fallen, trying to figure itself out. I said, if we can connect at that level, we'll be able to connect well. In every age somehow passes on, there is a conduit of passing on that particular material. That's good. But consequently, when Lewis seeks to eulogize the great myth he has in mind, this idea of evolutionism, and like scientism, it is for Lewis more like a religion and pseudoscience than anything Lewis would regard as true science. Nevertheless, Lewis does not believe, or he does believe, that many have been sucked into the vortex of this religion, especially those elements of it embedded in materialism and naturalism. By these, Lewis would have in mind some basic ontological assumptions that should rest at the heart of any worldview. In the Book of Miracles, which is an outgrowth of his wrestling with some of the barriers that he had to faith, and he was a materialist himself, he was an atheist, and he was looking for a worldview that would support his atheism, so he embraced materialism. But when he wrote Miracles later, he basically says that the basic ontological question is that a world flush with contingencies, ontology, the study of being and existence, in case you didn't know, comes from the Greek participle ontos, from the Greek verb eimi, I am, and so the participle would be being. And the basic ontological question is, in a world of contingencies, if anything exists, there must be something outside the string of contingencies. When you were a child, you remember when you strung up the dominoes on the coffee table? Something outside the dominoes had to exist to set them up. You push the first one over so that they all went falling down, this series of contingencies manifest. Hopefully you pushed it over before your little brother or sister did, because a new contingency started, you'd go slug your brother or sister. But nevertheless, something outside the dominoes had to exist for this to happen. What is it that is eternal or necessary? Because something must be eternal and necessary in this universe of contingencies. And the basic views that have been championed, there's many, many views, but they fall in certain categories. One of them is that things just happen. Nobody takes that view very seriously. No Rembrandt painting ever painted itself. No building ever constructed itself. No baby ever gave birth to itself. But the two views that most people have taken seriously, and it's the one Lewis took seriously when he was a materialist, and it's the one he thinks is taken seriously by the religion of science, is materialism. Matter is eternal. It's always been. And as Lewis tried to work through this himself, he bought it. You know, the brain is just mere cerebral biochemistry. And that should account for everything. There is no real meaning or value per se. But as Lewis thought more deeply about it, the materialist would say the man doesn't really love the woman. Her image is projected on the retina of his eye through a series of electrical synapses that travels along his optic nerve, stimulates the brain, causes secretion of particular hormones. He says it's love, but it's just chemistry. That's all. And Lewis had bought that until he explains later that it dawned on him that, in fact, the materialist, in his explanation, is looking at the lovers. They're projecting an image on the retina of his eye, travels along his optic nerve, stimulates his brain, causes secretion of particular hormones, and he says it's explanation. And he wants you to buy his explanation. But the thing is, if the lovers can't say love, then the materialist can't say explanation either. And Lewis saw the incongruity of this, and finally he writes in Miracles, "I cannot believe reason is mere cerebral biochemistry." The word mere is important because Lewis believes something biochemical is going on there, but it doesn't account for all that's going on there. And so consequently, as Lewis writes about this, he believes that the one explanation that helps us most is to believe something immaterial is eternal. And consequently, scientism, naturalism, materialism excludes that particular area of discussion, and consequently is bereft because of it. Lewis's own pilgrimage to faith required that he climbed over these essays. And furthermore, the myth Lewis eulogizes draws on his many years processing these things, as he records them in his book, Surprised by Joy, his autobiography. It's the autobiography where he's just trying to say how he came to faith. I don't know about you, but I'm suspicious of biographies and autobiographies if they're not humbly written. When I say humbly written, I want you to think for a second of all the thoughts you've had today. How many of them have you processed with another person? Now think of the cumulative effect of those things that have captured your attention. People, we remain mysteries to one another, often mysteries to ourselves. And when somebody says they're going to write the definitive biography, no, they're just picking and choosing. I would rather have an honest biography where a person is going to say, I will follow this theme in this person's life. Because they can maybe get some approximation of their life that way. But if they say they're going to give you everything, I just don't take them too seriously. And Lewis is just following his own process to conversion. You can read it, you can see how he got over some of these barriers. But Lewis also draws on his incredible breadth of reading to make an observation that would require such breadth if he's going to talk about why he thinks scientism is wrong. When I say incredible breadth of reading, he wrote one book called English Literature of the 16th Century, Excluding Drama. It's one of the 73 books that are out over his name. To write English Literature of the 16th Century, Excluding Drama, not probably a marketer didn't develop that title for him, but nevertheless, to write that book, he read every book written in English in the 16th century. He read every book translated into English in the original language it was written, Old French, Italian, Latin, and in translation, so his judgment could be credible. It's a prodigious work of scholarship, but it's just one book he wrote. And when you begin to see his reach into classical literature, early Christian literature, medieval literature, and even very contemporary literature, you begin to see that he's putting together then a set of observations that make it possible for him to make some judgments about what he thinks is fundamentally wrong with scientism. Most often, he observes, interpretive judgments are made after some discovery occurs. Here's something. What does this mean? How do we make sense of it? Of course, a materialist, if he's going to be faithful to his or her claims, isn't going to try and find out what it means, right? Because reason is mere cerebral biochemistry. But on the other hand, as we try to discover what something means, Lewis says the myth, scientism, the myth that he's trying to eulogize, drove the discoveries. People found what they were looking for. Philosopher Basil Mitchell, in his book Faith and Criticism, speaks of the risks of such occurrences. We're very unlikely to be neutral, he says, but Mitchell believes we can be impartial. How's it so? Well, he says you have to give the other person veto power of your impression of their position. I think this is really important in a marriage. If my wife Claudia says this to me, and I hear through my grid this, then we talk like this. 2 days later, I say, hey, Claudia, do you remember when you said this to me? She said, I never said that to you. I said, Claudia, I was in the same room with you. It's now a matter of integrity. And I can come to things with impressions that can shape the way I think them rather than draw my impressions from the things as I get closer to them. So the best way to make it work, as Mitchell would say, giving the other person veto power, because I can't be neutral, but I can approximate impartiality. Claudia says this. I say, Claudia, is this what you meant? She says, heavens, no. Where'd you get that impression? I said, well, be patient with me. I don't always get it right. She says, yes, we've established that in this marriage. So. I said, please give it to me again. She gives it to me again. I say it back to her. Is this it? Give her veto power. She says, that's closer, but it's not quite yet. One more time, please. She does it again. I say, is this it? She says, yes. Now we're on the same page. We can have a real discussion. And maybe I can say, oh, it's over. The discussion's over. I see what you say. I'm in. Or if I disagree, I can give useful information. I can say, that makes sense given A, B, and C, but were you aware of X, Y, and Z? She may say no. Or she may say, yes, I was aware of X, Y, and Z, but were you aware of L, M, N, O, and B? And so this idea of impartiality becomes important, but Lewis was saying that he felt that those who came up with what he calls scientism, this exclusion of the supernatural and transcendent in their approach to science, brought it with them to the data and found what they were looking for. Now, Charles Williams, who was an inkling with Lewis and Tolkien and so on, wrote, not one line in a thousand can be trusted to state accurately what its opponent says, much less what he thinks. And Basil Mitchell also, in another work, said, whatever credit or authority we give to any proposition more than it receives from the principles and proofs it supports itself on is owing to our inclination that way. I'll give you more on that in just a bit. But in Lewis's reading of the seminal literature of the West, he noted this mythological idealism long preceded what many in the mid-19th century and early 20th century world were thinking in relation to science. Some found what they were looking for. And Lewis notes in his Funeral of a Great Myth, every age gets the science it wants. So the corrective for Lewis is to keep focusing on reality, to see the thing as it is as best I can, to adjust the scoliosis of my thought, my moral life, my emotional life to the plumb line of that reality. Lewis was an objectivist. There are objects, both material and objects of thought, set apart by definition, and therefore capable to be thought about in an inferentially developing way. And not only are there objects, material, and objects of thought, there are also knowers in the world who can know these things. Furthermore, Lewis was convinced that truth is not reality. Truth is what I think about reality when I think accurately about it. So consequently, reality always acts as the corrective. If I say this is an elephant, while elephants may exist, this is not one. And the invalid claim can be demonstrated by the fact, as I get to know this, I have to limit or get rid of the false notion. That which is asserted by a false statement does not exist. False statements may exist, but that which they assert does not. And there can be opinions, like maybe I can't get to reality. I can get to probability. Reality, opinions are based on probability rather than certainty. They're subject to doubt. Reasonable people can differ in matters of opinion. But this reality that Lewis felt we should get to, he addresses it virtually every book he wrote. I can take you to where he's talking about the concept I'm going to lay out before you right now. Virtually every book, he either says it explicitly or he develops it. The explicit statement is, reality is iconoclastic. Reality is iconoclastic. I think it's the biggest idea in all of Lewis's books. What is an iconoclast? It's a person who breaks idols. I have an image of God. Maybe I have an image of some scientific notion or something like that. Anything. I have an image even of my wife. Lewis says, I want God, not my idea of God. I want my neighbor, not my idea of my neighbor. I want my spouse, not my idea of my spouse. I want myself, not my idea of myself. So I have an image, say, of God. Heard a sermon, read a book, had a late night conversation with friends. And that image, helpful as it is in the moment, if I hold on to it too tightly, it will compete against my having a growing understanding. If I still hold it, now I'm moving towards the mythological. And the image that was once helpful competes against my having a growing understanding. C.S. Lewis said, God always kicks out the walls of temples we build for him because he wants to give us more of himself. I don't know about you, but I like the idea of being a pea brain because it reminds me that I don't know everything. Matter of fact, I know very little, which is not a threat to me. It keeps me asking questions. It keeps me on the threshold of wonder and awe. And I think, too, that leads, if properly followed, especially in Lewis's faith-integrated understanding of the world, his supernaturalism, it leads to worship at the end of the day. So an iconoclast, again, as I said, is a person who recognizes, or in Lewis's way of describing it, surprised by joy, God always kicks out the walls of those temples we build for him because he wants to give us more of himself. The idea is not new with Lewis. It's been something that's been passed along in the traditions of the faith-integrated thinkers throughout time. And Lewis finds this way more robust than scientism, materialism, and naturalism. As a matter of fact, let me rehearse some of them. If you're married, write down the title of this poem. It's Robert Browning's Rabbi Ben Ezra. Every year on my anniversary, I read this to my wife. It's the one that begins, grow old along with me. The best is yet to be. About line 30 of that poem, Browning says this, then welcome each rebuff that turns earth's smoothness rough. We can think we have it all figured out, but the earth isn't smooth. It has texture, it has peaks, it has valleys, it has geography. Welcome those things that help you to see it the way that it is, rather than the way you have to have it be. Baron von Hugel, an author who influenced Lewis, a philosopher of religion, he wrote in his letters to his niece, Gwendolyn Green, beware of the first clarity. Press on to the second clarity and the third clarity. I would even suggest to you, in light of this, the supernaturalist can be more open-minded than the naturalist. Because the naturalist already has to conclude there is no supernatural, there has to be this kind of explanation. Supernaturalists can say there could be a natural explanation. God has put sources in the world, they're moving in a way. Robert and I have had these long discussions. Robert loves a way of ongoing creation, if I hope I'm representing you right, and how God's got things started, and consequently, is he allows humans to participate in that whole creative process. We can have farms, and we can have inventions, and we can have all kinds of interesting things. So this idea by von Hugel, beware of the first clarity, press on to the second clarity, is something you get in Tennyson's poetry. Tennyson's poem, In Memoriam, he writes, our little systems have their day. They have their day and cease to be. They are but broken lights of thee, and thou, O Lord, art more than they. Which system takes your breath away? The scientism that is limiting, or the supernaturalism that can be open to God's movement in the world and God's movement in my own life as I seek to understand that world, leading maybe to worship and so on. You see it in Augustine at the beginning of the Confessions where he says, the house of my soul is too small and large it, Lord, that you might enter in. Or you see it in the Bible in Acts chapter 7, where Stephen is accused of speaking against the temple in Jerusalem. And in his defense, as the people are ready to stone him, he says, "You think you've got God in that box up there on the hill? Don't you realize that when God first appeared to our forefather Abraham, it was in Mesopotamia, hundreds and hundreds of miles from where that box was? When Joseph went down to Egypt, he didn't go alone, God was with him. When Moses was taking care of his father-in-law Jethro's sheep in the Midian wilderness, and God appeared to him as a burning bush, that was a long ways from where this is. Oh yeah, when David wanted to build the box, God said, David, I appreciate the sentiments, but frankly, heaven is my throne. Earth is just a little footstool for me. How are you going to build a box on earth that's going to fit me?" And then, of course, here's Lewis again. In Prince Caspian, when Lewis, Lucy, the most spiritually sensitive person to go into Narnia, when she goes back into Narnia for the second time, the first time she sees Aslan, the lion, the Christ figure of that world, she exclaims when she sees him, "Aslan, you're bigger." He says, "Oh no, child, I am not. But every year you grow, you'll find me bigger." Scientism inflates the observer and diminishes the world. Supernaturalism helps us see a larger understanding of the world. And while it doesn't inflate us, it causes us to awaken to worship, adoration, and wonder. I'll talk more about that in a bit. And so consequently, change follows on the heels of disequilibrium. One's present conceptual framework is always up for revision. In a complex world with pea brains operating in it, change will always be necessary. But we get to ask, what kind of change? Is it a change of kind? I've got to scrap the whole conceptual framework in order to adjust to the new data that's coming in? Or is it a change of degree? A tree doesn't have to give up its interior rings just because it adds more. That's a change of degree. But if it doesn't add more, then it's just not growing. In fact, Lewis believed most scientists operated in the realm of objectivity. He says it clearly. He uses the word most. He has a high view of the sciences. But he writes, to the biologist, evolution is a hypothesis. It covers more of the facts than any other hypothesis at present on the market, and is therefore to be accepted unless or until some new supposal could be shown to cover still more facts with fewer assumptions. At least, that is what I think most biologists would say, Lewis writes. But in science, evolution is a theory about changes. In the myth that he's eulogizing, it is a fact about improvements. Lewis says that true science makes no cosmic statements, no metaphysical statements, no eschatological statements, but the myth knows none of these reticences. Nevertheless, Lewis sees not all scientists stick to the proper course, for immediately after noting the objectivity of most scientists, he recognizes some who seem to be driven by different agenda. Citing Professor D.M.S. Watson, Watson says, evolution is accepted by zoologists not because it has been observed to be true, but because the only alternative, special creation, is clearly incredible. Here, Lewis rightly observes, in cases such as this, the sole ground for believing is not empirical, but metaphysical. The dogma of an amateur metaphysician who finds special creation incredible. Lewis says, in the myth, however, there is nothing hypothetical about it. To the myth maker in this regard, the scientism person, that is, the myth presents itself as a last word, ending debate. If you read the discarded image, around pages 15 or 16, somewhere in there, Lewis talks about Galileo. And he said Galileo was right in his heliocentrism. But he says, the church has often taken it on the chin because the church wasn't utterly wrong about Galileo. There were people in the church who were obnoxious, to be sure. But nevertheless, what did Galileo say? He said the planets went around the sun in a circle. And the church said, Lewis said, took judgment on him for his theory of theories that he had made a last word about it. And in Galileo's own lifetime, another astronomer is going to come on the scene and says the planets don't go around the earth in a circle. They go around the earth in an ellipsis. And his theory of theories that he'd had a last word needed to be revised. as all theories will have to be revised as new data comes in, and we accommodate for that new data. So anyway, when this trickles down to popular culture, the religion of science trickles down to popular culture, science is cited as a kind of absolute. Some people say, and all too often, as it's uttered in popular culture, well, science says, as if the debate's over. Or, as the scientists have affirmed, these statements coming when they do seem to imply that science supplies an absolutely settled matter ending all debate. No serious scientist believes that. And in these cases, there's almost a kind of ignorance of the writing of people like Thomas Kuhn in his book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, where he says the whole history of science has been trying to accommodate itself to new discoveries and to accommodate themselves in a way where there's wonder and awe. You should hear Robert talk about science. You should hear him talk about physics. And it's a worship experience just to hear him talk about it and listen. A case in point that I would like to give would be an experience I had in a classroom in this very building. I had a student, and she told me, was teaching a C.S. Lewis class, she told me that her best friend from kindergarten would be coming from Brown University to visit her on her spring break. I go, wow, she's a bright person. Brown University, an Ivy leaguer. And my student said, I'm concerned about her because she's an atheist. I'm going to bring her to the Lewis class. I was wondering if you could talk with her about spiritual things. I said, I'd be delighted to. So after the class, they came forward. And I commented, wow, my student says that you guys have been friends since kindergarten. Tell me about that. Not many people have friendships that last that long. What a gift. And then after that, I said, she said, you go to Brown University, an Ivy leaguer. You must be very bright. What are you studying? She said, biochemistry. I said, wow, you're brighter than I thought. That's a challenging major. I said, so we talked about spiritual things in the class today. What do you think? She says, well, as a biochemist, which I thought was a little premature. She's only a sophomore. She says, as a biochemist, I live by the principle. If I can't perceive it empirically, I just don't believe it. Scientism had trickled down. I said, that's the principle you live by? If you can't perceive it empirically, you don't believe it? She says, yes. I said, well, then please set that principle forth for me empirically. I hope you see the problem. It's a principle. It's not perceptual empirically, that particular statement. She freaked out. She had that moment of disequilibrium. She was ready for change. She said, I never saw the incongruity of that principle. She said, why, everybody at Brown University believes this. I said, no. No, there's Christians there too. You'd be surprised, they get everywhere. I said, plus, I've talked with materialists who wouldn't assert that. So let's be fair to the materialists too at that point. I said, now don't get me wrong. I really appreciate what the scientists do. But there's a limit to what any of the divisions in the liberal arts understanding of life can do. I said, for example, John Polkinghorne, who had degrees in theology and physics, taught and was a president of one of the Cambridge University colleges in England, was also pastoring a church at the same time. I heard him once ask in a forum about these things, and he said, well, if you ask the scientist, why is the kettle boiling? The scientist would say, heat from the burner is agitating the molecules of the water. And at 100 degrees centigrade at sea level, it causes it to boil. He said, that's an answer to the question, and it gives you the measurable features. But Polkinghorne said, but I could say to you, I wanted a cup of tea, and would you like one too? He says, that answer is also significant and important, but it's not an answer the scientist by mere scientific method could give you. Mortimer Adler, the philosopher at University of Chicago, made this observation in 4 generations. We've gone from saying that which is measurable is significant for science to saying that which is measurable is the only thing that's significant. There's a huge loss at that point. And so many things that are human that the supernaturalist could account for as well as with his science or her science, the mere materialist couldn't account for. This is significant. By the way, that woman came back the next year to my class. I said, how are you doing? She says, I'm an agnostic now. I said, hey, that's progress. Lewison notes that having first turned what was a theory of change into a theory of improvements, scientism then makes this a cosmic theory. explaining the whole universe. Not merely terrestrial organisms, but everything is moving upwards and onwards. Reason is evolved out of instinct, virtue out of complexes, poetry out of erotic howls and grunts, civilization out of savagery, the organic out of the inorganic, the solar system out of some sidereal soup. And conversely, reason, virtue, art, and civilization as we now know them are only part of the crude or embryonic beginnings of far better things, perhaps even deity itself in the remote future, this view that we will somehow elevate ourselves to God. Estimations of what is known or can be known are inflated. The judgments that follow on the heels of these false notions become dismissive of other points of view. Opposition is silenced, and the prevailing myth persists almost unquestioned. In the public sphere, you can hear echoes of it in comments like, well, he's on the wrong side of history. Have you heard that one? How do you make that judgment? Who has the wide grasp of saying, this is what history has said in all the years before me? As I read history, it's complex. Furthermore, who can say he's on the wrong side of history because they know where history is going? Isn't it much better to say, what are the principles you're arguing? And can we look at those inferentially and discuss whether or not they have merit in their own right, instead of trying to dismiss anybody who would think differently by saying, you don't understand all of history as I do, and they forget their pea brain, or you don't understand where history is going like I do because I'm omniscient. It's just nonsense. And it's basically, again, this myth that is pervasive. No debate, no hermeneutical suspicion, just the judgment that seems to suggest someone in a finite moment could say something universal about where history has been or where it's going. As Lewis suggests, the myth that existed before scientism persists in drawing on the myth for judgments about the future. Man has become a god. The facts are immaterial. And Lewis writes a book along these lines too called The Abolition of Man. He felt it was one of the three best books he wrote, and I would say anybody who studies Lewis should know this book. I lost track of how many times I've read it after about 60, but I think it's significant. I don't think it's uniform in its significance. It gets progressively worse as it goes along. But the first chapter is brilliant. And in the first chapter, Lewis tells a story of Coleridge at a waterfall. The story was recorded by Dorothy Wordsworth, the sister of William Wordsworth, in her Grasmere Journals, 1803. They were at the Coralin Waterfall on the River Clyde in Scotland. And Coleridge was standing there just in awe of this waterfall. I've been there. I wanted to go see it for myself. And it is a magnificent waterfall. Not a long cascading one, but more of one coming down in tiers. And Coleridge is looking at it, and this one tourist says, the waterfall is pretty. Another tourist said, the waterfall is sublime. Lewis recounts this story in a book he calls The Green Book. It was really The Control of Language by Alec King and Martin Kentley, but Lewis doesn't embarrass the authors, calls it The Green Book, and refers to the authors as Gaius and Titius. His goal is not to confront the authors, but to address the myth, to eulogize once again the myth in another place where it appears. And they say Coleridge had no right to make a judgment about the two tourists, one who said sublime and one who said it's pretty. Because neither of the tourists were really saying anything about the waterfall, they were only saying something about their own feelings. And Lewis says there's all kinds of philosophical things in peril in that particular kind of judgment. First off, the reality meant nothing. And they kind of sever from the reality, what these judgments are. The worst part about it, though, is that Gaius and Titius, in making the judgment, Coleridge had no right to say that, are making a judgment, aren't they? And what's the basis for their judgment if they have severed themselves from some reality? If there's no reality and he's just saying something about his feelings, then why would Gaius and Titius make a judgment about his statement there? But they do. Lewis says they've divorced themselves in this book from what he calls the doctrine of objective value. He gives it a shorthand. He calls it the Tao. And the Tao is this belief that certain things are really true and others really false, the kind of thing we are, the kind of thing the universe is. There's Lewis again saying we got to get to reality and try and understand it. And not only that, he says that this objective approach to reality is necessary. Little side here. There's got to be some transcendence. We would say it's revealed, we Christians. Either revealed in nature, you had mentioned something about this earlier, right? Revealed in nature or revealed in scripture. And somebody could say, yeah, well, what's going to keep you from just saying whatever you want it to be? And Lewis notes this in Reflections on the Psalms. He says, the worst of all bad men are religious bad men. The quicker I might be willing to die for my faith, maybe the quicker I'd be willing to kill for my faith. Or paint a thus saith the Lord across my own opinions. Or maybe use the Bible would be my application, like a ventriloquist uses his dummy. But this same sort of error can take place when the scientist drifts towards scientism and makes the same kinds of religious pronouncements, and it becomes problematic. So if there's this objective transcendent reality, how do I get to it? It can't be just merely my assumption. It has to be done in some sort of community. It's interesting in the Bible, for example, about 60% of the yous in the Bible are plural. We English-speaking people are bereft because we don't have, except by convention, the ability to say a plural you. It's dropped out of our language. Oh, people in the South, they might say y'all, but really if you go to the South, if you want plural, they'll say all y'all. Californians say you guys. But the Bible, if it's given to be understood with the plural you, it's to be understood in community. We get around an objective reality and we begin to discuss it. If we divorce ourselves from that, then you do have mankind of playing God. You have a kind of anarchy. And anarchy doesn't seem to work very well. Anarchists make very bad community people. And furthermore, if an anarchist ascends to power, then there becomes tyranny. Or alliances are made, and we come up with a party that's going to come up with what Lewis calls a pseudo-Tao in chapter 2 of that book. And he says if people reject objective reality, to function, they're going to have to come up with something. Just like Gaius and Titius, to function, had to come up with some sort of a pseudo-Tao. And they make their judgments. He says it could be economic value, it could be instinct, it could be any number of things. But Lewis says at the end of the day, if we give up on objective value in chapter 3, you end up with the abolition of man. That which gives value to what it means to be human is diminished or dismissed, and then all of a sudden humans are marginalized and minimized as well. But Lewis adds, the myth does not end here. He says it's interesting that the myth, when you listen to the scientism advocates, they have a final assertion to make. Lewis says in the myths of old, the gods and heroes all die. Siegfried dies in Norse mythology. Arthur dies in the legend. Roland dies in the story, the Song of Roland. And now, Lewis says, we hear from scientism, the sun will cool, all suns will cool, the whole universe will run down. Life, every form of life, will be banished without hope of return from every cubic inch of infinite space. Lewis says it all ends like an Elizabethan tragedy. The universe burns out. All is despair. All is hopeless. There is, in the end, no meaning, no purpose, no value. As a materialist began, there was no real meaning or value. It just started chaotically, or matter that had no material features to it, was just there. But no purpose, no intention. Lewis's supernaturalism is very different than this. Lewis resists scientism and the despair of materialism. He embraces fully the more robust supernaturalism that can account for meaning and purpose. People, creation implies intention. When the potter goes to throw the clay on her wheel, she has in mind what she wants to do with that clay. Make a bowl, make a pitcher, make a vase, make a cup. Creation implies intention. Lewis steeped in the literature of his day. Recognize this in Dante, particularly. We all know Dante's Vita Nuova and his Divine Comedy, but we not are always familiar with the Convivo or the De Monarchia, two books he wrote between his first book and his last book. In the De Monarchia of the monarch, Lewis cites Dante as saying this in a couple of his books, that Dante said, function precedes essence. Function precedes essence. Before God ever made you, he had a purpose for you. Drawing on the creation account, God creates light on day one, but he doesn't create the luminaries, those essences that have the function to emit light, till day four. Function precedes essence. God knew what he wanted for you before he made you. You matter. I have 13 grandchildren. I'm concerned about it because, you know, the dwarves in Hobbit can't go reclaim their ancestral home with 13 dwarves. They have to have a 14th member. And so Bilbo goes along, and I've decided when the 14th baby is born, whether it's a boy or a girl, I'm calling it Bilbo. And now I have news we just got over Christmas that there's two more grandchildren coming, so I guess it's going to be Bilbo and Gandalf. But nevertheless, my son, Grady, who's a pastor in Phoenix, Arizona, his wife wanted to have four kids in 4 years, get that part over with and raise them together as close as she can as friends and so on. Well, it didn't work. She had four in 3 years. She had twins the last pregnancy. And there's a boy who came, they're fraternal twins, the boy came first, and his name is Soren, after Soren Kierkegaard. And his sister's name is Briley. Isn't that a beautiful name, Briley? And when Briley was born, the doctor held Briley and said, she is 2 weeks anatomically younger than her brother. My daughter-in-law ovulated and became pregnant. 2 weeks into her pregnancy, she ovulated again and became pregnant a second time. It's so unusual. I've heard other cases. You know, how did you buy a new car and you drive on the freeway and you see other cars like that one, even though you'd never really noticed them much before? And I thought to myself, God must really want Briley in this world. Isn't that amazing? But then you think of all the eggs a woman emits and all the sperm ejaculated by a husband when he makes love to his wife. The fact that any sperm and any egg ever connect, every one of you are here against all odds. You're more likely to win the lottery than to engineer your being here. Function precedes essence. And I was reading in my quiet time this morning where David says, Lord, I worship you, that you chose me from the tribe of Judah to be the king of Israel. And you chose my family to be the one through whom you will send the king who will reign forever. I'm overwhelmed. And somebody might read that and say, well, he chose David, but look at me, I'm just on the outs. No, every one of you was uniquely chosen by David for purposes that he has for you. And this purpose is infused in the universe as Lewis looked at it. And consequently, too, Lewis is able to say there are no ordinary people in the weight of glory. You've never met a mere mortal. Every person you ever meet will be either one day a perpetual glory or a perpetual horror. And every one of us has the weight of glory upon our shoulders because we're ever nudging people either towards the everlasting glory or the everlasting horror. We live in a real world that has meaning and purpose. And we live in that world with some level of responsibility. This cultivates a sense of value, purpose, and duty, as well as humility, wonder, gratitude, and worship, and by contrast, makes scientism look pretty thin. And I would go so far as to kind of end with this. The book that Lewis wrote before he died, it's a book full of worship and adoration. It's called Letters to Malcolm, chiefly on prayer. Usually if somebody says, what's your favorite C.S. Lewis book? I say whichever one I'm reading at that moment. But probably I go back to this one the most. Letters to Malcolm, chiefly on prayer. There is a word in this paragraph that I'm going to define for you, but I want to give you the paragraph and talk about it for a second. on the robustness of supernaturalism in contrast to scientism. The word is the word coruscation. Coruscation. I'm going to define it not to insult your intelligence. You probably already know it. I had no clue what that word meant when I first read that. But a coruscation is a sudden flash of brightness. We could talk about fireflies. I grew up in Southern California. I never saw a firefly in my life except Pirates of the Caribbean at Disneyland. And when I moved to the Midwest, I still am in awe when I see fireflies coruscating in the back garden on a humid summer evening. Or as our weather comes often from west to east, and we see dark clouds coming, and we can see lightning coruscating in those clouds. You get the idea of the word? Okay, so here's what Lewis says in this paragraph. He makes a distinction between gratitude and adoration, two responses to the world when a person sees that the world is infused with the presence of God, infused with the purposes of God, infused with supernatural, transcendent value. Lewis says, gratitude exclaims very properly, how good of God to give me this. But adoration asks, what must that being be like whose far off and momentary coruscations are like this? One's mind runs back up the sunbeam to the sun. Wow. I remember when I first read that, it was about 1979, 1980, and it was when Voyager, that interplanetary probe, was speeding past Saturn, that most mysterious planet in our solar system, right, the one with rings. And we got the first pictures up close and personal of that mysterious planet. I still have my Time magazine with the pictures, I still have my National Geographic with the pictures, I've kept them. You know what they discovered when that thing went by? They discovered that the outer ring of Saturn was braided. Braided. And I asked Lewis this question, what must God be like that he chose to braid the outer ring of Saturn that no human being had ever seen before? One of my best friends in the world's a physicist. I say, Robert, why is it braided? He says, these are some of the things that keep us physicists up late at night. I'm confident one day they're going to tell us. I've read five different explanations, each one a negation of the others. I have a friend who's a fireman. I explained it to him one time that the outer ring of Saturn is braided. And he says, yeah, Jerry, we don't know if he didn't just braid it for the picture. I think of ships that park themselves over depths in the Pacific Ocean greater than the light of sun can reach. And they dangle cameras into those depths and they take pictures of fish painted neon bright. Why? Can't be an attractor made. As a matter of fact, how do fish in those depths get together? That itself is an interesting question. It can't be to protect themselves from predators. There's no sight in that depth. At least sight as we know it, as humans. And I just think to myself, what must God be like that he chose to paint fish neon bright in the bowels of the ocean? I grew up in Southern California. I always like to see palm trees silhouetted against an auburn sunset sky, or a mountain range silhouetted against an auburn sunset sky. Now I live in the Midwest. A cornfield silhouetted against an auburn sunset sky. There's beauty there, I have learned. There is beauty there if you would willingly distill it out. But we could have lived on a darkened planet and gotten word from on high, there'd be one sunset, and we could have lined every west coast of every continent and every island on our globe, and we could have regaled our progeny with the glory of that moment, writing of it in our journals and in our diaries. But what must God be like that he's made our planet a perpetual kaleidoscope of sunrises and sunsets? One star, I think, twinkling in a night sky itself should be enough to awaken awe and wonder in the hearts of every right-thinking, right-feeling individual. Scientism will shut this out, or if scientism cannot shut it out and they drift towards us, they have to ask, is there something else going on here? But one star should be enough. But what must God be like that he has glittered the night sky with stars and moons and shooting stars and comets and galaxies? And I wish you could have been with me when I was at Wheaton College's Northwoods campus up by Lake Superior called Honey Rock, and I was teaching a class there that summer at midnight. The students are knocking on my door, Jerry, they're out. And I came out, and there were the northern lights pulsating and coruscating in the night sky in reds and blues and greens and whites. And we did the only just thing, because justice is to render to a thing its due, something scientism doesn't know how to do when it comes to the natural world. Supernaturally created, supernaturally infused with purpose. We stood on that ski dock up there from midnight until 2:30 in the morning, singing songs of praise and adoration, fully knowing who to thank for the glory of that moment. What must God be like that he made delicate things, like flower petals, hummingbirds, peacock feathers? Oh my heavens. But Lewis is too honest to stop there. Lewis forces his readers to also ask, what must God be like that there are earthquakes in Haiti, tsunamis in Japan, AIDS babies born in Africa, or a history where women have been abused by men from time immemorial? Lewis forces us to ask the hard questions. He says in Mere Christianity, if our religion is objective, then we must never avert our eyes from those elements in it which seem puzzling or repellent. For it's precisely in the puzzling or repellent where we begin to see what we do not yet know and need desperately to know. The supernatural point of view doesn't have to suppress evidence. Scientism is suppressing evidence right and left. They can discover all kinds of things, but there's something going on. There's a thumbprint or a fingerprint. Something transcendent that's infusing these things with meaning and purpose. The materialist can cry out against the injustice of the world, but he does so without a transcendent, objective moral foundation for such outcry. Furthermore, in the religion of scientism that denies the supernatural, one's eyes are blinded to the transcendent as a source of grace and hope in that world. In fact, this is what Lewis himself discovered in his own pilgrimage to faith. We are broken people living in a world that has not been abandoned. The God of the universe has entered that world and made it possible for us to be reconciled with him and find in our hearts the fulfillment of our deepest longings. And so that would be Lewis's case against scientism, right? Is that okay? I should leave a little time for some...
And we have some time for questions, so who would like to start?
Anybody have a question? If you ask a really hard one, I'm going to deflect it for Robert, because he's really smart. Should we give him a mic?
I'll talk real loud.
Let me give you a mic. Aren't they recording it?
Are
you sure?
Walk the mic around.
Plus, I don't have my hearing aids in, so I can't hear a word you're saying.
I loved your talk, and I loved your point about scientists wanting to explain everything based on observations. But I wonder if you
are... Good scientists do that.
Yeah.
And most of them Lewis thinks are good.
Yeah. But I'm wondering if Lewis or yourself ever encountered people in other fields, perhaps theologians, who might understand by their observations how God works, and therefore they can claim that they understand what God will do. You are asking, how great is he? But are there some that say, I know how great he is, and that's an equal problem?
That I know how great he is?
Yeah. Or someone claims that.
I don't think it would be bad to say, I from my experience, know that God is great. I think it might be a problematic if I say, I know the extent of his greatness. Habakkuk chapter 3 has this passage where it says, In the expression of God's glory, there was a hiding of his power. The Bible tells me God's omnipotent. I don't know that from observation. I can say, he created Mount Everest. That's pretty impressive. Or he created the Himalayas. That's pretty majestic. Or I can look at the heavens and say, look at this. We just keep going deeper and deeper and farther. That's outstanding. That's breathtaking. But all of those show something of his creation, but they don't show the extent of his omnipotence. So in the revelation of his glory, there's the hiding of his power. And I think that's important. And I think as Christians, we sometimes will use words flippantly if we're not careful. We throw out the word absolute so unguardedly. I believe in absolutes conceptually, like I believe in the infinity of numbers conceptually. But if I told you I knew the infinity of numbers, you'd have me put in a mental institution someplace. When I say absolute, if I believe that there is some absolute transcendent power, and I have good reason for believing that, we can discuss that. That's one thing. But sometimes the world hears me saying, I know absolutely these particular things, and I don't have that reach or grasp. Remember, I'm a pea brain. Does that help? Is that stretching? Were you reaching? All right. I'm sorry.
Hi, thanks. I look to Paul in Thessalonians 5:21. He says, test everything.
It says what?
Test everything.
Test everything.
Hold on to the good. And then John says in 1 John, test the spirits. Reveal Jesus Christ.
Yep.
They are true. What does C.S. Lewis, or what did he rely on in Scripture to help him make this transition that you described today?
What did he rely on in Scripture?
I think any particular scripture?
Huh?
Any particular scriptures that he relied on, that he points to in his writings?
I think Lewis was a whole Council of God guy. I mean, he read his Bible once or twice a year. Every day he read it in the English, and he read in the Greek every day. He read multiple numbers of translations, or at least the available ones that he had, and often read the Latin Vulgate too. So he was highly committed to it. So my guess is that was the plumb line by which he would measure these other things. He's not an evangelical in the sense that he has some doubts about some things of Scripture, but he has a high view of its authority. But even when he expresses to Professor Kilby, who taught here for years and started the Wade Center here at Wheaton, which is the largest collection of Lewis material in the world, he wrote a letter to Kilby saying what some of his reservations were about Scripture. And you go, I don't know how he had those reservations. They seem sort of infantile for a guy like Lewis. For example, he says one of the things that gives him pause is the discrepancy between the two genealogical accounts of Jesus in Matthew 1 and Luke 3. He says there seems to be some discrepancy there. Well, I look at those genealogical records, I see no discrepancy whatsoever. They are blatantly different. So how would you account for that? Well, let me ask you this. How many genealogical records do you have? You actually have two blatantly different ones, one from your mother, one from your father. And if he would have looked a little deeper, he would have seen that Matthew 1 is the legal line that comes through Joseph, and it goes back to Abraham. The other one goes all the way back to the promise that was made to Eve in the Garden of Eden, and I think it's Mary's line, and it goes to David through his son Nathan. Interestingly enough, if you read the biblical record, there was a king, Jeconiah, who it said of him, due to his evil, no linear descendant of his would ever sit on the throne of David. And in fact, the regal line that comes down through Joseph was not the biological father of Jesus. So even though that line comes down, fulfills a promise to Moses, it does not violate what the scripture said about a descendant of Jeconiah. But through Mary, we can have that line. And it goes back to David through Nathan. But Lewis didn't look at that, obviously. And he saw something, and I don't know why he didn't think about this difference between Mary and Joseph. The other one is he's got the 1 Corinthians 7 passage, where in 1 Corinthians 7, Paul's talking about divorce. And he said, the Lord said to you, not I. And then later he says, I say to you, not the Lord. And Lewis says, it seems that Paul's making a distinction between his writings and the dominical statements of Christ. When in fact, that's not true. In Matthew 5 and Matthew 19, Jesus talks about divorce. And Paul recounts those statements. And then he embellishes on that. And he talks about another reason why divorce may be legitimate. And at the end of that passage, he says, and I think I have the Spirit of God too. So Lewis didn't think through some of these things. That's okay. All of us are incautious at times. None of us could say, oh, my thinking on things are as pure as the driven snow. But he would make mistakes. But in another writing, Lewis says, Pascal contradicted Scripture when he wrote this. Clearly, therefore, Pascal must be wrong. There's a man who has a high view of Scripture. And so testing the spirits, he looks at the whole counsel of God. Could he have looked at it more deeply? Yeah, just so we are. How many of you have read through the Bible? I'm in my 47th read right now through the whole Bible. And I've read the New Testament 31 times besides that, and I've gone through the Greek Bible once fully, and I'm in my second read of the Greek Bible. Every time I read the Bible, I go, where was that last time I read it? And every time I read it, I see something that doesn't make any sense to me. And I don't let it bother me. I put it in the pending tray, like a scientist would do. This is a scientist, right? Let's talk about that. Biologist. Put it in the pending tray. Another time or two through the scriptures, I get the answer to that question. And that's happened so frequently that when somebody says to me, oh, I read the Bible, it's full of contradictions, I say, I don't think you know what you're talking about. I've read it differently. I've read it like this. Okay, so if it's got those depths and somebody makes a mistake, when I make a mistake on it, you don't have to be utterly dismissive. It's a deep book. There's a lot of evidence that it came from omniscience. It's amazing. Is that helpful a little bit?
Sure.
So it'd be more a general answer than a specific text that he might refer to. Yes?
I'm interested in that question, and I loved your talk. What's the dating of the Kilby letter compared?
Say it again.
What's the dating of the Kilby letter about scripture that you just mentioned versus Fernseed and Elephants, the essay on criticism?
I don't know when Fernseed and Elephants came out. You know what? Isn't that Modern Theology and Biblical Criticism retitled Fernseed and Elephants? That came out late in Lewis's life. That's probably late 50s, early 60s. But the Kilby letter, I think, is around 56 or 57. Yeah, and you can find it in the letters. Do you have the collected letters, all three volumes? So look at Dr. Kilby. He only wrote to him 17 times. And it won't be hard to locate. Is that helpful? All right.
Say
your name, sir.
My name's Michael.
Michael. You know what your name means? It means, who is like God?
Right.
Every time somebody calls your name, you just have to say nobody.
So.
Hey, Michael.
Nobody. So, from what I understood from your talk, the kind of idea that trying to, like, let's say, like, a particular person says that, like...
Say it again, go slower.
Sorry, so... From what I understood from your talk, when someone says that the ways of, I guess, the universe are like can
the
ways, be
the what of the universe?
The ways like to like understanding the universe, basically understanding things that are basically can all be summed up in like a naturalistic way, and that they
scientism would suggest that
right. Then and from that viewpoint, that would be a reductive way of saying of viewing the universe in general. Like it's a reductive worldview. Wouldn't it be appropriate, instead of thinking of it as reductive, as instead saying that viewing that everything can be explained within the universe is actually a way of kind of like a revelation? I've heard a lot from, I guess, like, from, like, I guess, church and fellow, like classmates and professors that the universe is, in many ways, like infinitely complex, or can be viewed as like extremely complex, since we still haven't gotten to like a certain core understanding of the universe. How there is like a still discontinuity between like quantum mechanics and Einstein's general theory of relativity, for example. Isn't it appropriate then to take like view the world as understandable, in that God wants it to be understandable to us, but it's kind of like a sorry, I'm kind of like rambling a little bit, but...
It is a long question.
That the universe can be understandable, but that it's complex, that we dig deeper and deeper and deeper for like an infinite amount of time.
I think that's a fair judgment. If you're going to talk about quantum mechanics, we'll have to defer to Robert. But I can say this about a Lewisian approach. And we can talk about the infinite universe. Those are assumptions we're making, right? Nobody's ever been out there to see. But it's certainly complex, and it's certainly massive and big, you know. I said to a friend of mine once, I think God is big. He said, Jerry, the Pacific Ocean is big. God's enormous. Okay, so anyway, whatever. The point is, though, Lewis believed that we don't get a last word on anything. That doesn't mean we can't have a last word in a sense of a court of appeal like the scriptures. But he meant we don't get to the bottom of anything. We don't see the breadth of anything or the height of anything. But because we don't get a last word in that way, that doesn't mean we can't have a sure word about some things. And from that sure word, we can begin to make some reasonable inferences and expand our knowledge in a way whereby we can have confidence. And by the way, confidence too has con with and fide faith. There's got to be some operations of faith that keep us inclined to discovery more and more. So that means then that every truth I know can still be plumbed more deeply, can be applied more widely, and can be seen in coherent relations with other truths. The truth I know I hold with humility, and I know that it still has a capacity to continue to take my breath away as I study it more and more. There might be times when things I thought were true proved not to be true, but that's all right. In that moment, I'm moving closer to truth because I'm jettisoning the thing that was a false notion and moving towards something that's clearer. And I don't have to worry about that. By the way, I think too, this is another boon for the person who is not only a supernaturalist, but a follower of Christ. I believe fundamentally Jesus loves me. I have good reason for it, and we can recount those in a moment. But the thing that blows my mind about it is if he loves me, then if I don't have it exactly right, I'm secure enough in his love to continue to look and modify and amend. Because my sense of self doesn't rest on whether or not I have it right all the time. My sense of self and security rests in this fact. The God of the universe knows me and loves me ontologically. God is love. That means his love cannot be diminished by my poor performance nor improved by my good. There's a basis for good scientific study. Start from there. Is that fair?
Is it okay that I can ask just a little bit more?
Yeah, if you want. You might need the mic. Because after all, you keep reminding us by your name that nobody's like God. You can ask all you want.
So I wanted to kind of clarify, because I was kind of rambling a little bit, that when we take the supernatural, instead of viewing the supernatural as something that is basically inexplicable, as in when we're...
Not utterly explicable. If you say it's explicable.
Inexplicable.
I mean, if you say it's inexplicable, then you're suggesting you can't know anything about it at all. That counts against even God's revelation. So I wouldn't even go on that line.
I'm trying to bring the supernatural into the natural, if that's an appropriate thing to do. As in say something is supernatural, but instead of it being something that is outside the realm of possible human knowledge, say that's something that we can drive toward to instead.
Yeah. Well, Calvin writes about that. He says he thinks the Bible's divine baby talk. God is always reducing down in manageable terms something that we as finite beings and pea brains can understand. That's significant. And I think that Lewis writes an essay on this called Transposition. It's in the book The Weight of Glory. How does the greater explain itself to the understanding of the lesser? How does a person with a master's in education explain difficult concepts to their kindergarten student? And they can come up with vocabulary, but it's going to have to be reductionistic at some level. But it could be very helpful for that student to get to a fundamental basis whereby they could develop over the years of school to understand more deeply. Lewis says a dog doesn't understand pointing. If you point, the dog will come smell your finger, but not see what the finger signifies. It can be taught that, because we taught our dog Dudley how to do that. But nevertheless, something dropped on the floor, he could eat it, we would point, and he didn't get it, it comes, I'd take him over to it. Well, we do that numbers of times, he realizes what the finger signifies. But Lewis says even this, that before he became a Christian, he reasoned his way through the morass of atheism and materialism as a supporting worldview, through agnosticism. He reasoned his way through the different religious options. And finally, as a theist said, he didn't think he could know God personally any more than Hamlet could know Shakespeare. And then a year and a half later, after a long night conversation with J.R.R. Tolkien, Lewis became a Christian, and he said he realized his analogy was actually a good one. Because Hamlet, the character in the play, could never break out of the play to get to know the author. But Shakespeare, the author, could have written himself into the play as a character and made the introduction possible. And he says, I think that's what happened in the incarnation. So we don't know everything about Jesus, but we know significant things about him. enough that it could reconcile us to God when we have a relationship with God. Anyway, anybody else? Yeah, here's one. I'm sorry, sir. If you shaved your head with that white beard and glasses, you'd be a handsome guy.
Well, two questions. My name is Blair. First of all, do you know what my name means?
Say it again.
My name is Blair. Do you know what my name means?
Blair?
Yeah.
Blair.
Yeah.
No.
Stumped you. Good. Second question.
Do you know what it means?
Yeah, flat level plane. It's not inspiring. Flat level plane. It's not inspiring.
You can do that with your head, see?
I can work. But the important question, just in your experience in ministry and evangelism, what do you think is the appeal of scientism?
The appeal of scientism? Well, it could be many things. I thought about this even as I was preparing this lecture. It could be that some people are drawn into it because it's part of the culture. You have a lot of people in our news media right now. You'll have left or right, I don't care who it is. They will vilify the position of the other person. They'll vilify them and see weakness in the character of that person. All the while talking about it as if they're above the fray. And there becomes this arrogance in that's applied. And it's just horrible what's going on, horrible. And so consequently, you'll have people that'll get sucked up in the vortex of right or left thinking without willing to listen and engage. We begin to think, well, if somebody believes differently than me, they must just be stupid. Now I become the standard, the plumb line by which we make these judgments. And if I'm doing it in such a way, I could say, you know, this person here, they did something I don't agree with that. But there's a lot of things I don't see. I want to listen to them. Tell me what it's about. I was on an airplane. I'm a pro-life guy. I've spent jail time for pro-life stuff. And I was on an airplane one time, and I'm talking to this woman. She's a LiPo woman. She was an obstetrician from San Francisco, and she travels around the world giving lectures. And as we started talking, she brought up that she was pro-choice. And I said to her, you're pro-choice. How is it that you have that position? I said, no, don't tell me. Let me see if I can guess. Are you pro-choice because you are concerned about the plight of a woman who's in an unwanted pregnancy, maybe by virtue of rape or incest, or maybe she's incredibly poor and she's got a lot of children already, she doesn't know how she's going to feed them, or she's pregnant and she's been abandoned by the person she made love to? Is that why you're pro-choice? She said, yes, of course, why else would I be pro-choice? I said, those are good reasons. I said, but the thing is, though, I always look at it like there's two lives involved. And I wonder if we really solve the problem if we only look at the one life. And is there a way that we can engage in this? Well, we are sucked into a vortex of cultural assessments that keeps us from engaging with other people. And if we judge the person as being a person worthy of vilification, and we think we're above the fray, now all of a sudden there becomes an arrogance that begins to occur, and so I think we've got a lot of people who are sucked up into the vortex by virtue of the example of that's going on all around us. I don't think they're bad folks, but they are. I think there are some people, they are sucked up into the vortex, not that they're not bad folks, but they are. No, they are sucked up into the vortex, okay? I think we've got other people, though, who just are ignorant. They haven't really thought through some stuff. Not just culturally, but they just haven't engaged with some stuff or cultivated friendships of people who might look at things a little differently. I think you've got other people, though, who can be engaged in what the moral philosophers have called akrasia. In Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, he says that if I have violated some sort of moral good, the only way I can live with myself is if I begin to rationalize those bad acts. He says vice is unconscious of itself in the Ethics. C.S. Lewis said in his preface to Paradise Lost, continued disobedience to conscience makes conscience blind. Or Paul said, we suppress truth in our unrighteousness. So some people look for a worldview that will support them in their desire to move towards a moral blindness that will allow them to engage in bad behavior. And so those are at least three reasons. If there's three reasons, there could be 300 reasons. Is that fair? Okay.
Great.
Great.
A couple
so,
more. Oh, are we running out of time?
Yeah, we are actually over time.
All right, so I'll wait here if somebody wants to.
But I think Jerry would be happy for you to come up and, yeah. and ask him questions here. Let's thank Jerry Root for a very rich speech.